Welcome to Foul Players Radio, your podcast for arts, entertainment, and pop culture. My name is Michael Spedden, your host. Every episode features interesting people with fun, fascinating stories about their journeys in the performing arts. Authors, actors, musicians, dancers, athletes, comics, you name it. Sit back, relax, and have a listen. Let's have some fun. Foul Players Radio is a proud production of the Foul Players Group and a proud member of the SJ Network. And welcome again to Foul Players Radio. My name is Michael Spedden, and tonight's guest is Jeff Scott Soto. I had a great time talking to Jeff this past week. His career in music goes all the way back to the 1980s, singing with many bands along the way, some really great ones like Yngwie Malmsteen's Rising Force, Talisman, Journey, Sons of Apollo, Trans-Siberian Orchestra. He sang with Joel Hoekstra. He sang in his own band, Soto, as a solo artist under his own name, Jeff Scott Soto, and on many tribute compilation albums over the years. We joked a little bit during the interview that you cannot swing a dead cat without hitting a Jeff Scott Soto project somewhere online. He's involved with so many things, so many albums he's been on, and videos he's appeared in on YouTube. I mean, he's all over the place out there, folks. Most recently, he just released a solo album under his own name, Jeff Scott Soto, called Wide Awake in My Dreamland. It's a great album. It just released a couple of weeks ago, and I've listened to the heck out of it, and it's really, really solid stuff. But what would you expect out of Jeff? You know, I mean, he's just amazing. There's an album called Origami that came out in 2019 with his band Soto, an album called 2020 that was released this year with Sons of Apollo, which is also great, another one called Psychotic Symphony that he released about 3 years ago. So I would say, you know, just with these things alone, not to mention all the other things he's doing, probably one of the hardest working men in showbiz. And he's also going to share some information about TSO for this Christmas. There will be a performance, I believe, on December the 18th online, so he's going to tell us about that. So stick around, subscribe to Foul Players Radio for free on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Cast, Castro, Castbox, Overcast, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or at foulplayersradio.buzzsprout.com. And before we start, I'd like to thank my good friend Ed Stilk for helping me put this interview together. I've been friends with Ed for a very, very long time, and Ed's been friends with Jeff for a very, very long time. And he introduced me to Jeff at a Sons of Apollo concert in Washington, D.C., about a year or two ago, and I had a great time meeting him, and, you know, Ed was just wonderful in helping me put together this interview. We had a great time talking tonight, and we heard Ed a couple of episodes ago on Foul Players Radio when we had Nikita Brezhnikov and Mike Dells on talking about old school wrestling. If you enjoyed that episode, Ed'll be back. We're going to be talking about some other things, wrestling included, in the not-too-distant future, so keep your ears open for Ed, and Ed, thank you, my friend. This was wonderful, and I appreciate it. And we'll be back with Jeff Scott Soto right after these words. Hello, listeners. I've got some great news from one of our former guests. Barbara Bustard has just released a book called The Art of Healing, 12 step-by-step meditative art exercises for improved physical, mental, and spiritual well-being. Miss Bustard bares her soul and shows us who she is through her stories and exercises. This is a book to be felt and experienced, an artist's work. Art is a way to work through all that life gives us, whether it is happy, sad, or anything in between. Art is a creative, safe, healing, and everything special place. It is the place to work through the stress that underlies all disease. In her book, The Art of Healing, 12 step-by-step meditative art exercises for improved physical, mental, and spiritual well-being, Miss Bustard describes the process to make healing happen. The meditative exercises in this book are described in a very simple, clearly articulated manner. They are appropriate for any level of artistic experience. Just reading this book, Miss Bustard's exercises touch you at a feeling level. You are moved from your thinking analytical brain to creative expression. It is available now on Amazon for $29, and it's gotten many positive reviews from readers so far, so pick up your copy today. Her website is artforbodymindandsoul.com. Also remember, the holidays are just around the corner. We all love to support our local small businesses and artists. Make sure you get your copy today. It makes a great gift. Foul Players Radio is now a proud affiliate of the SJ Network. If you're a performer, an actor, musician, filmmaker, author, you name it, in need of a good publicist, call Steve Joyner. 816-605-4561, or you can email him at stevesjnetwork@gmail.com. He has many years of experience in the entertainment business. He's competent, confident, and takes great care of his clients. He would be the publicist for you. Call Steve at 816-605-4561 or stevesjnetwork@gmail.com.
Hey, what's up, guys? This is Chris Rastalli of Breaking the Fourth Wall. If you enjoy our show, you can find it on YouTube. Just look up Realm of the Mist Entertainment, or just look up Realm of the Mist Entertainment on Anchor.fm, Apple iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, or wherever quality podcasts can be heard. And also, you can find us on all the social medias. Just look for Realm of the Mist Entertainment, and I will catch you on the other side.
I'm Michael, the host of the semi-monthly podcast, In a City Like Yours. Join me as I chat with interesting people with interesting life stories. You can listen to the podcast on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can follow us on Twitter at IACLYS Podcast, as well as on Facebook and Instagram at In a City Like Yours Podcast. Please feel free to let me know what you think, and keep coming back for the many interesting stories in a city like yours.
Hey, this is Don Smith from the Life Radio Show. If you've always wanted to learn more about the world of low-budget filmmaking and even lower-budget comedy, tune into the Life Radio Show. You can live stream the show at WWSU1069.org on Tuesdays from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern, or find us wherever you find podcasts and like and follow the Life Radio Show on Facebook for live video and other shenanigans.
Hey, what's up? This is Chris Rastalli of Realm of the Mist Entertainment. The podcast you are listening to is part of the SJ Network. Go to s-j-network.com. That's s-j-network.com for more great podcasts and information on those shows, as well as information and ability to contact publicist Steve Joyner for more information. Just go to the website and check out the family. Ladies and gentlemen, until then, enjoy the show.
So, Jeff, it's Jeff Scott Soto. It's an honor to have you on Foul Players Radio this evening. You know, I've been following your career for decades now, it seems like, and it was really nice to have the opportunity to meet you at a Sons of Apollo show about a year or so ago, and then you know, have the chance to talk to you tonight. So, welcome. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. Well, it's one of the perks or one of the curses, I guess, in knowing Mr. Ed Stilk.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, he's somebody I've known since my time with Journey, and yeah. We stayed through the years, and he's just one of those great supporters, loyal guy, and he hooked us up. So let's have some fun.
Absolutely, absolutely, Ed. I've known for about 38 years now since we were in ninth grade.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've known each other since we were freshmen in high school, and he's just been, when you have a friend like him, you really have something, you know, and he and his wife, his lovely wife, Lori, are just, and his brother, John, I'm sure you know him too, are just, you know, and his wife, Kathy, are just wonderful people. So, I guess when I first started following your career, I was in, later high school. I heard, Yngwie Malmsteen, and I had actually seen you in concert at the Baltimore Arena. I think we brought this up when we met. You and Yngwie and were opening for Triumph.
Right.
It was around 87. So
it was 86.
86.
Because, yeah, the Triumph tour was 86. The last shows I did with Yngwie was a little stretch of the Somewhere in Time tour, or Stranger in the Strangeland. I forgot what the name of that tour was that Iron Maiden did in January of 87. And those were my last shows with Yngwie before my final departure in January of 87.
Okay.
So it was definitely 86.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, because you were very young in performing, with him. And, he always had a reputation of being a taskmaster, and you know, you better be at the top of your game if you're going to be on stage with him, you know. I wanted to ask a little bit about your background. Did you go through vocal training? Did you study voice, or were you a natural? How did this come about, really?
Yeah, I didn't take any vocal training until I developed vocal nodules about, I'm going on 18 years ago now. I got these nodes before even I was with Journey. We'll get to that. But one of my biggest fears in getting the Journey gig was that I was going to be able to keep it up, because getting the nodules, my range certainly dropped a lot. I mean, you hear it in my voice right now. I've been singing all day, and when you're singing a lot, you get raspy. You naturally grit out a little bit. But after the vocal surgery, because that was my only choice, really, I didn't really have the luxury of having the 6 months off of zero talking, zero coughing, zero whispering, nothing. Mm-hmm. That was the only other choice I had besides surgery. I knew that it was going to be a struggle getting that tenor back, that natural tenor back up there. And it wasn't a beginning, but the only vocal lessons I took were after the first leg of the Journey tour. I actually went to Steve Perry and Steve Augeri's coach, and he gave me a routine that literally got me there every night. It was an exercise that I would do. It was an exercise for a tenor singer, or mainly a baritone singer, which I was by then, who needed to get that tenor higher natural voice going up. Right. So yeah, going back to the Yngwie days, no, everything was natural. Everything was based on growing up, and basically trying to emulate everything I listened to. I was always in cover bands. I was always in metal top 40 bands, singing everything from Kiss to Scorpions to Van Halen to Crocus and all that stuff, that good stuff from back in the day.
Oh, absolutely.
And from that, I naturally just learned how to impersonate my favorite singers or the singers I was singing the songs to. Mm-hmm. And even at the beginning of my tenure with Yngwie, I hear it now. I didn't hear it then because I didn't really have a style yet. But when I listened back to the young me, I realized all I was doing back then is like impersonating Ronnie James Dio and Bruce Dickinson, and trying to basically, by impersonating them, I was assuming that I was emulating the proper heavy metal tone, the heavy metal singer kind of operatic thing that those guys were doing. And I guess it kind of got me there. It was enough to get me the gig. It was enough to get me through the gig.
Right. Yeah, that was, it was just you know, listening to, you know, just some of the notes you were hitting back then. It was just amazing, you know, your range. And I've been watching, you know, a lot of, you know, you can't swing a dead cat without finding you somewhere online, man. It's like,
I like that one.
Yeah.
I'm going to steal that one.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've been on about 942,000 albums and singles and, you know, I mean,
you're missing a few.
Yeah. It just seems like it's just one project after another. And, I hear, you know, you do have a pretty broad range, you know. I mean, from the things that I've heard you hit when you were singing with Yngwie and Journey to some of the things that you sing with TSO.
Right.
You know, how many octaves is that? Have you, you know, do you know, or?
Well, yeah, it's funny when people say, or when singers brag about having a 3 or 4 octave range. And my comeback is always, yeah, but what are you going to do with the really high and the really low part of it? Mm-hmm. Unless you're doing Barry White kind of talking, getting down to those real bassy notes and trying to sound like Geddy Lee on Helium, what are you going to do with those really highs and those really lows? So it's funny when somebody brags about those octaves, because it's kind of goofy when somebody tries to utilize them all.
Right.
I pretty much tried to remain within the 2 octaves of where my voice spit comfortably back then. Since then, I've kind of brought it down. I'm not a full octave, but I don't like to go up, especially when I'm recording and writing and creating new music. I don't like to go up too high or too uncomfortably that I know if I sing this live, there's no way I'm going to be able to pull it off. Because, yeah, I'm human. I just turned 55 years old. I can't do everything I did when I was 18 or 28 or even 38.
Right.
But realistically, I can still cover a wide gamut of it, because if you start kind of in the middle, there's only one place to go, is high. But if you start kind of lower middle, you can get to the medium high and it still sounds high. And that's kind of the trick of the trade. You want to be able to represent who you are and how you sing without having to conserve it and to really kind of pull it back, and people go, wow, he used to be a great singer, and now look at him.
Right. But I mean, like I said, you know, you're definitely holding up, you know, with, you know, I mean, there's, like I said, you know, I was looking through when I was doing my show prep. I'm usually out when I take my walks. I've been listening to your albums and, you know, getting myself fresh on this and, you know, listening to videos and things like that. And I don't think you're running out of gas anytime soon, you know. You're definitely... Well,
if you sat in the room with me when I was tracking, you'd probably hear a different story, but thank you for that.
Sure. So, you know, just, God, so many things, you know, that just, you know, would love to, you know, ask you about here. We could just kind of jump around a bit, too. You know, getting back to TSO, you know, as I had mentioned to you when we were kind of doing our show prep, you know, since, you know, I met my wife, you know, almost, I guess about 10 years ago now, we've been together, almost 10. And, you know, when I first, you know, got with my wife, you know, she turned me on to seeing TSO live. And she had been doing that, I think now, I think this will be like her 15th or 16th year, it would have been if there was, you know, the tour. And, and, you know, her mother is a absolute diehard fan. You know, she's turned, she'll be 89. Wow. And she is still going. And I have a feeling that we're going to be, you know, whether we have to wheel her in there in a wheelchair or whatever, I think up until the end, she's still going to be game to going to TSO concerts. And, you know, it would be nice if one of these years you could make it over to the east side, you know, instead of doing the west.
I hear that. Time, brother. Yep. It's probably not going to happen. My dear friend and the musical director of Trans-Siberian Orchestra, mm-hmm. Al Petrelli,
yeah.
He was the one who pulled me into the fold. Sorry to cut you off. I don't know if you were done with your thought.
Yeah, I was. But,
it kind of got me started on wanting to give you kind of an insight on that. Mm-hmm. It literally was not even a week after I was fired from Journey. Mm-hmm. I've known Al for over 30 years. We met in Sweden when he was playing guitar for Alice Cooper. Mm-hmm. And I was with the band Talisman. We were doing the very first Talisman tour. The very last show of that tour was at a festival in Sweden with Alice Cooper headlining. And so I, you know, as you normally do when you play these festivals, you play your gig and you're pretty much hanging out and watching all the other bands. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, went to the hotel. It was flight night, so I knew I had to get up early and fly back to the U.S. after the, mm-hmm. you know, when morning came. But instead, I opted to hang out at the hotel bar and meet my new and dear friend Al Petrelli, mm-hmm. who was basically holding up the bar, and and we became best of friends back then, and we still are to this day. I remember running into Al at a wedding, a friend of ours wedding in 2001, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me about this TSO thing, and I'd heard of it. I remember seeing the commercials, because this is when, by 2001, TSO had already been, they'd already split the band to two. Mm-hmm. They had an East Coast and a West Coast production, because it was impossible to do the entire U.S. within the course of the Christmas holiday with one band. Mm-hmm. So by then they had already gotten to that status. And I remember Al telling me about it, because, yeah, I'm doing this thing. Oh yeah, I've seen the commercials. I saw you guys were out there, and explained to me what it was about. I just remember looking at him like, when your dog sees something funny and it turns his head sideways. That was kind of how I looked at Al when he was explaining what TSO was about.
Right.
It made no sense to me on paper and on just on textual words. Mm-hmm. My only reply was, hey, good luck with that. I hope it works out for you. Mm. Not even 7 years later, 6 years later or something like that, I get a call from Al. Mm-hmm. He said, hey, man, I heard the news. Sorry to hear that. Listen, I'm in the studio with my boss, Paul O'Neill, the creator of TSO, mm-hmm. and we're working on a new TSO album that's non-holiday themed. It's not one of the Christmas stories. It's not one of the holiday themed stories.
Right.
It's called Night Castle. And he said, we have checked out every singer in the book, all the singers in our repertoire, all the singers that we know, all the singers all of the above. Mm-hmm. And I told him about you. And he basically said, Jeff Scott Soto, you mean the guy in Journey? No, he's a tenor. I need a baritone. Mm-hmm. And Al sold me hard. He said, Jeff is a baritone who can sing tenor. You should check him out. Huh. Al told me, if I'm interested, they want to fly me out. I flew out to meet Paul O'Neill. It was an interesting meeting, to say the least, because Paul is a historian. He's very, very well versed in politics, as I said, in history, and mm-hmm. in just in literature. He could have been a professor if he wasn't a rock and roll producer.
Right.
But basically, I spent the next 7 hours with Paul O'Neill in the studio talking about Night Castle, talking about the character of the songs that he that I was coming out to sing for. I hadn't heard anything to that point. Mm-hmm. After discussing for something like 7 hours, we finally, he said, I want to hear you now that I've given you the insight, I've given you the character, because he is like a casting director, the way somebody that would, they would have to give you the insight of your character before they're going to say, okay, read the lines. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to just put me in the studio and hear Jeff Scott Soto here sing these songs. He wanted to hear the character that was written for these songs singing those songs.
Right.
Literally spent 15 minutes in the studio after 7 hours of speaking to him, and he sent me back to L.A., asked me if I wanted the gig. And that's how this amazing, amazing ride started with TSO. And I'm proud to say I'm 13 and a half years later, I'm still part of the family. And to answer your question before you ask it, yes, I will be involved in the live stream that's coming up in December.
Oh, great, great. That's wonderful. We're going to be watching. I'll tell you that much. You know,
I appreciate that.
Looking forward to that.
It truly, and not only was it, I'm not a musical theater guy. I'm not a Broadway guy. I never was interested in that whole world and that whole arena of mm-hmm. music. So I thought this was not for me. But Paul heard and saw something in me. Mm-hmm. That I didn't even know I had. And he brought that out in me. And I'm telling you right now, I learned so much from that man. God rest his soul. We lost him a few years ago.
Yeah.
I learned so much from him that I actually utilize in what I do today. And I've utilized it in TSO. I've utilized it in my own career. Mm-hmm. These things I would have never harnessed, been able to know where to draw from, if not for Paul O'Neill.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, you know, he was just something else here. You know, I mean, I've listened to these, you know, all the TSO albums over and over and over and over again. And, you know, they don't get old, you know, they don't get yeah. old. The material stands up and, you know, it's very, very, you know, the concerts are very, very moving concerts, you know,
yeah.
Because you go through a whole range of emotions, you know, and, you know, with the whole story up on the boards behind you going on and, just the different moods of the songs and everything. I mean, he really, you know, just put together just a complete, you know, this is just masterful work here. And I think that it must be just amazing to be part of it after all these years, too.
You have no idea. And even just the fact that in the very early stages, even the guys in Sabotage, who are the originating yeah. members, you know, they were mm-hmm. Sabotage during its demise is what turned into TSO. Mm-hmm. Everyone, John Oliva to Johnny Lee Middleton to Chris Caffrey, even Alice Skolnick was part of it, and of course Al Petrelli from the mm-hmm. beginning. These guys in the very beginning were like, I think Paul's literally lost his marbles. This sounds like the worst idea you can possibly dream of.
Right.
In terms of, because on paper, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. This will never work. Mm-hmm. And just the fact that you even brought up that your mother-in-law, or is it your mother or mother-in-law?
Mother-in-law.
Yeah, the fact that she, at her age, still loves this, mm-hmm. and I'm going to borrow a few of Petrelli's words and thoughts on this. Mm-hmm. The fact that we can look out in the audience and see a 70-year-old grandmother with a reindeer crocheted sweater and a teenage kid with a Slayer t-shirt sitting next to her enjoying the same show is the most surreal thing mm-hmm. one could ever even imagine. Ever becoming a musician, never in everything that we work for in our lives, we would have never imagined that mm-hmm. there would be a concert or an event that would appeal to the extreme demographics like that. And yeah. that's what TSO is all about.
It sure does. It sure does. I mean, you look around the crowd and everything, and again, you're absolutely right. You kind of, you said it, you know, a lot better than I was going to. I mean, it was like, you see, older folks, you know, a 70-some-year-old grandmother next to, you know, a couple of guys in, you know, Slayer shirts or something like that. And or then you even see, you know, the 70-some-year-old grandmothers, you know, with the TSO tour shirts on, you know, looking badass.
Or with the Slayer shirts.
Yeah, right, right. yeah, that's true, too. That's true, too, you know. Well, good. Well, you know, so we're looking at the actual show itself. I guess there's probably, you can't give away the story, or you can't really
give away nothing.
Yeah, you're not going to give away the surprise.
Born to secrecy, and to be honest with you, there's some things I don't even know about it yet, and that's by design, where we truly are on a need to know basis.
Right.
We basically are told what's expected of us when we arrive, and we're going to be working on. But the overall layout and platform of it, I have no clue, and I don't want to know, because I leave this in the hands of the professionals. They've been doing this for over 20 something years, and they do it so well. I got nothing. There's nothing I can know or need to know about this that's going to change anything. So right. I'm happy just to be one of the cogs in the machine and brings this thing forward, and people around the world get to enjoy it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, wonderful. Well, we're definitely looking forward to watching it. Absolutely. Definitely looking forward to watching it. And I believe it's going to be on December the 18th.
Correct.
Okay, great, great, great. Well, like I said, we're looking forward to seeing it here. So I have a whole bunch of other questions here for you. The Sons of Apollo, there was an album out this year. There was one out in 2017, all well done. And what a lineup of guys, you know.
Yeah.
Billy Sheehan, I've been drooling over his playing because I'm a bass player myself, ever since I was in high school and heard. Did you ever used to listen to Metal Shop, that radio show? I don't know if you remember that or not.
I don't know. Maybe I did, or maybe I wasn't cognizant of it.
Yeah. It was one of those shows that the rock station in Baltimore, where I'm from, used to play on Sunday nights. And they would, showcase, I guess kind of like underground or, up and coming metal bands. And I remember hearing Talas on there. And I think they did a little interview with Billy, and, their material just blew me away back then. I'm sure they were still pretty much local to Buffalo at that point, but, really starting to break out. And, what a bunch of gentlemen.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't see what goes on backstage or on the tour bus, but at least with us,
And Billy is actually he's the oldest one. I'm not the oldest, but he's the one I've known the longest. He's the one I've known since my first tour with Yngwie was in 1985, and Talas was our opening act. So I got to know Billy and the rest of the band pretty well, and we've stayed friends ever since. The fact that it took us 30 years to finally work together is beside me, but the fact that we're doing it now is I'm just over the moon. Sometimes I have these pinch me moments. I look over my shoulder and I see that Bumblefoot's on guitar, Billy's on bass, Portnoy's on drums, Derek's on keys, and then I look and I go, how the hell did they get me? What am I doing here?
Because
I'm humble to the fact that I don't see myself as one of those super guys. They always talk about Sons of Apollo being a super group and all that. Mm-hmm. I don't look at myself as that. I don't see myself. I see myself as somebody who's been lucky and fortunate to do all the things that I've been able to do and the opportunities, et cetera. But I don't see myself as a Clark Kent with glasses and I put on a cape and I become this super singer. Mm-hmm. And so I look at the fact that I'm fronting this band, and it truly is, it's another humbling moment in my life and my career that I get to do something so unique and just so badass, even at this stage of my life and my career. I mean, look at Billy himself. He's in mid-60s and he's still breaking new ground. I mean, the stuff that we're doing, Sons of Apollo, is just it's another world. It's another world that I've never been a part of.
Right. Yeah, and I've seen him a number of times in concert too, with different things that he's done, like David Lee Roth and, different things. And it's like, I walk out of these concerts either wanting to go home and just burn all my bases or just practice the hell out of them. He's just very, he can be both inspiring and frustrated at the same time, but a hell of a nice guy,
That whole era of when I would say Edward was the first. He was one of the first. I'm going to take Jimmy Page and Jimi Hendrix and those guys out of the equation, because I'm talking strictly hard rock guitar and guitar that ended up being the majority of what hard rock music was in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So it pretty much started with Eddie, and then it went to Randy. Mm-hmm. And then somebody like Billy, he was the pioneer of that kind of bass playing for rock music. There's nobody else doing what he was doing.
Oh, yeah.
And he said the standard. Mm-hmm. And then Dream Theater came along, and Mike Portnoy set a new standard for being a drummer.
Yep.
And then you got somebody like Derek Sherinian, who plays the keyboards like a guitar player. When he plays a solo, it sounds like a guitar solo. It doesn't sound like just like a wanky Casio. And I'm not saying this to offend any keyboard players. Mm-hmm. Just in general, he does things with the approach of a heavy metal John Lord, if I may.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then you got Bumblefoot, who's taken what all of these guys before him, the Steve Vais, mm-hmm, and the Nuno Bettencourts and the Eddie Van Halens, all the guys that just took it to the next level, the Yngwie Malmsteens of the world. Mm-hmm. And he set yet another standard and another course.
Oh,
Bumblefoot. I'm like, even in my prime, I don't belong in this band.
No. You're there because you're a logical choice. I mean, you are amongst the elite, Jeff, you know that. And I've seen a lot of bands and I've listened to a lot of records over the years. And, I would say you're right where you belong, you know,
hasn't been a short road, I'll tell you that much.
But, talking about, Ron, Bumblefoot, hell of a nice guy. He was just a very, I spoke to him a little bit after that show, and what a just genuinely just regular, nice guy too. And,
very humble.
Yeah.
Very smart, very unique. Everything about it, I can go on and on and on. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to bore you because he's one of those guys that became one of my dearest friends so quickly because of his personality.
Yeah.
Everything about him suits how I live my life and how I present myself. And sometimes I'm reminded, sometimes when you're on the road, when you're not feeling up to the public side of things, when you're just tired and you're kind of fed up, or you've had a long day, or your voice is not working well, that guy just knows how to take that right out of you. It's kind of like the Karate Kid moment at the end of the movie where Daniel he was down for the count, and Pat Morita clapped his hands and rubbed them together, and he did something to him that put him back into that final fight. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of person that Ron Thal is.
Right. And I was impressed that he ended up touring and singing with Asia last year, wasn't it? I was like, wow,
he's a force to be reckoned with.
He's just something else. I mean, he's also was with Guns N' Roses for a while, and yeah. He's just another one that's just done so much here, which kind of leads me to my next question here. I mean,
sure.
Throughout your career, and I mean, like I said, I've been following you since '86. You have just gone from one just incredible, situation to another one. These folks that you've played with, TSO and, the Sons of Apollo and Yngwie and Journey and all these other ones here. Is there any bucket list that you could possibly have left? Nowadays it's kind of a fashionable thing to say, well, I have a bucket list for movies I want to see or a bucket list for places I want to go. But I mean, you have just done so many amazing things and played with so many amazing people. Is there anybody out there that you haven't played with that you wish you could have?
There are only two left as far as in general in my book. I mean, I've jammed with everybody, and even one of them that I'm going to mention, I've jammed with before. I am lucky enough and humble enough to call him a friend, but we've never actually worked together in the studio. And one of my dreams would be to do something with Brian May.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why in kind of emphasizing what you just said about all the opportunities I've had or done or been a part of, mm-hmm, is a huge testament to Queen. It's a huge validation to what Queen gave to me as a band and even as an artist. They set the standard for not having a standard. They
right.
set the bar for not having a bar. Mm-hmm. They were able to do everything in the kitchen sink and get away with it because they made you believe it. It was so believable. It was real. There was nothing false about it. They could go from disco to funk to mm-hmm. hard rock, heavy metal, to opera, to blues, to jazz, to pop, to ballads, to you name it, they did it. And this is one of the reasons, one of my driving forces, I guess, that gave me the inspiration and kind of the influence to want to do all of the above.
Right.
I always wanted to be looked or seen upon as that kind of talent, of that kind of caliber of singer, writer, whatever. Mm-hmm. Even as a performer, you know, I was so enamored by Freddie Mercury and how he was able to make the person at the back of a stadium, not an arena, the back of a stadium, mm-hmm. feel like they were part of the show, the same as the people in the front row.
Yep.
That was the bar. And nobody, as far as I'm concerned, has been able to get to that bar. Nobody's been, but God bless it if I'm not going to die trying.
Oh yeah.
And so, yeah, I would love to do something with Brian, but mm-hmm. I would want to do it in a Queen fashion. I would want it to sound like Queen, because right. I know Brian too, when he does his own stuff or he works with other people, he tries to inject other sides of him. And if I were going to do something with Brian May, I would want it to sound like Queen.
Sure.
The other one that I would love to go into musically and just genre, because it was such a huge part of my DNA in my life, is Prince. And that's clearly not going to happen.
Oh, sure.
I'm so moved by, again, Prince was just one of those. There were no walls, there were no barriers, there were no boundaries. Mm-hmm. He took it to another level, and then he broke that level and brought it to another one after that. That, to me, was the epitome of an artist. And right. So when you have Freddie and Prince as their kind of as your go-to subjects, kind of as the ones that are inspiring and pushing you forward, there's mm-hmm. no way I'll die trying to reach that level. I'll never be able to reach it, because that level is just unattainable.
Right. I've got, you know, a couple of other ones here too. I saw that you, and, you know, speaking of, you know, being surrounded by great people, and even though you're not in the same groups, you know, when you're out doing TSO every year, I'd heard the Joel Hoekstra album that you know, had yeah. sang on and everything. And, he's another one who's just absolutely great. You know, I really admire him. I'd seen him perform not only with TSO, but with Night Ranger. And I plan to go see Whitesnake as soon as things open back up and he gets out doing that too. What's it like working with him? I mean, he's,
Joel is, I would say he's the guitar player version of me in terms of his drive, his ambition is mm-hmm. beyond even the capacity of what that guy is capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
I met him many moons ago. He was playing guitar for one of these all-star groups that the Nelson brothers have called Scrap Metal, where it's kind of a musical chairs of a who's who of different, whoever's available. They when you book a Scrap Metal show, you know you're going to get the top-notch guys or girls from that era, mm-hmm. and they're going to do their hits, and they're going to do it Nelson songs, and it's just a really cool kind of celebration band.
Mm-hmm.
So Joel was kind of the house guitar player for Nelson. I met him then, and watching him play all the different styles, just nailing everything from Winger to Mr. Big to, and at that time when I was singing Journey, he had to play Neil Sean, and he was just crushing every single thing. I'm like, God, this guy can nail everything. He'd do everything.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing I turn, he's a Night Ranger. And so we were acquaintances then, but we really hit it off during his Night Ranger tenure, where I was doing a solo album called Damage Control. And I was trying to reach out to Jack Blades to maybe do some co-writing with. And for whatever reason, it didn't work out time-wise or whatever. But at the same token, I brought it up. I guess Joel heard me talking about it backstage, and he reached out to me because, dude, If it didn't work out with Jack, or even if it does, I'd love to work with you. I've got a bunch of song ideas, maybe something you can use.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'm always listening, always open ears to check out new stuff. And I hadn't heard Joel's style. I hadn't heard of what he does on his own personal level. That guy wrote me some great stuff. One of my singles from that album is a song called Look Inside Your Heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of us working together. And then, of course, he got the Trans-Siberian gig, and then he got the Whitesnake gig, and he got Cher, and he was the guitar player for Rock of Ages.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever is necessary, that guy's the go-to guy. He's so good.
Oh, he is.
So humble, so nice,
mm-hmm.
Very professional. Very humble. Beyond talented. It goes without saying.
Mm-hmm. They are. I mean, I've just and he's, you know, a very personable guy too. My mother-in-law loves to do the meet and greets after the TSO shows.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's just, you know, she becomes everybody's mother-in-law then, you know, you know, Joel and, Chris and everybody, you know, Rob Evan, you know, who's usually done the East Coast stuff too. Just some of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet.
Absolutely.
Very humble, very down to earth. And I can imagine that when you get in the heart of that tour, that that schedule has got to be brutal. Two a days in a lot of these cities. What's that like?
You know what? It's not as brutal for the singers as it is for, I would say, the band and maybe the girls who are up there having to dance between singing.
Right.
Somebody like me, it's a dream gig, and I'm not saying it's easy by any stretch, but I'm saying it's easier. And this was Paul O'Neill's design for TSO. He's grown up all his life working with, being surrounded by, producing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, working with all these different people in the different walks of life and in the music business. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he said was the one thing that kills a singer first is, besides all the elements and if you're smoking and drinking too much and doing all that stuff, is you're bashing your vocal cords every night for an hour and a half, 2 hour set. Mm-hmm. And you're doing a set that's basically going to take its toll on your voice. So by design, he knew he wanted a TSO show that was second to none, but that was long enough that it was going to rival anybody else that could ever do a show like this. But he's not going to burn out his singers. And this is the design of why there's so many vocalists. The reason why I only sing two or three songs per show, because at the end of the day, if I'm doing two shows, I'm still only singing six songs. Uh-huh. That's a paradise for a singer. For me to be able to go up there and do something that's comfortable in my range, something that's not hurting me vocally, that's giving me a chance to sound as good on opening night as I do on the very last show, that was his design in making sure that the singers just don't burn out. Uh-huh. Now, again, you're going to be your worst enemy. You're going to be your worst decider of your own fate. Mm-hmm. If you decide to stay up late nights, yapping and laughing with everybody, drinking wine to the wee hours of the morning, not resting your voice and not doing what you're supposed to do, even those six songs per show are going to burn you out.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a ritual that goes both ways. You kind of have to. You have to understand your voice and how delicate it truly is. Mm-hmm. But you also have to, as my buddy Eric Singer would tell me, know the gig, keep the gig. Mm-hmm. When you know the gig, you know what's required of you. That's the only way you're going to keep that gig, because the first signs of you sucking is the first signs of you getting fired.
Right. I know. And I can imagine, you know, I mean, you're very personable with everybody up there, but in this class of this class of musicians here, I mean, they're not going to have any tolerance for slacking off or pulling your weight either. You know, so
I gotta admit that you kind of tapped onto something earlier about Yngwie being such a taskmaster. Because of me getting my first foot in the door, so to speak, as a professional singer touring, etc., with Yngwie Malmsteen. And him being a taskmaster, he expected everybody to be at the top of their game, as he was. Mm-hmm. From that, I walked away from that ideal, wanting to always be at the top of my game, always to want to work with people and surround myself with people who want to be at the top of their game. So it kind of was par for the course for me that he was so hard on us, or not, it wasn't leaning on us. You just knew if you sucked, he was going to look over his shoulder like, I heard that. Mm-hmm. And you don't want that from him. You want smiles and validation every time you get on that stage. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of stuck with me even as a teenager. And I kept that ideal through all the years. It made me not drink, not smoke, not get into drugs, and really take care of myself as a singer, because I want to be able to deliver every night. And that person spending $150 for that front row seat is just as important to me as the one that paid $25 for the nosebleeds. I want to sound good for every one of those people who are spending their money to come in here and hear me sing.
Right. I have a similar story, you know, with my own career. You know, I've been a musician for a long time, but I've been mostly focusing on acting the last 12 years or so. And, you know, one of the gigs that I got, you know, I was just coming up as pretty much, you know, like a theater actor in character in theater, and, you know, small bit parts and everything. But then I auditioned for, and I got, you know, parts in a repertory theater in DC doing, you know, Shakespeare and, you know, Jacobean theater. And it was with a pretty elite group of actors. And I mean, I tell you what, welcome to the pros when I got down there. And, you know, when you're working something like that and you're really, you know, stepping up your skills and doing that, you strive to do that because there's a lot of satisfaction and kind of, right. You know, both in reaching the next level and, you know, and you can tell. And that's another thing too, is that, you know, whenever I do a show, I want the people to be satisfied. I want them to be happy. I want to go out there. I never phone anything in. And, you know, being in an environment like that really brings that out of you. And it's a hard habit to break once you're there, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So
I get that. I totally get that.
Yeah. So a couple of other things I wanted to ask about here. I noticed, too, that you're on a lot of compilations here. I was looking around, and I see that you've, you know, a number of compilation albums, like, you know, tribute to this band, a tribute to that band. I had heard one of them that I really liked. It was a version of Aces High, and you had, you know, a number of people with you on that. I think Billy Sheehan was on that, and I
knew no better for it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. How did you get these? How are these put together? Like, does somebody has an idea to put a record together? They just, you know, start asking around, or did you hear about it and get together with these guys and decide you wanted to submit something? How do these albums get put together?
Those were a string of records from my dearly departed bro, Mr. Bob Kulick, God rest his soul as well. We just recently lost him.
Yeah.
He started the round of those back, I forgot, but I guess it would be early 90s. I'm not sure exactly when that started. Mm-hmm. I think I was on the second or third one. I think he'd already done a Queen one, or he'd already done a few of these kind of all-star roundup type of things, kind of what I was explaining with the scrap metal thing. Mm-hmm. Bob was very well-versed, and he knew everybody in the business. He'd worked with so many people, and even through his connections with Kiss and his brother Bruce and so many people, he's just known through the years. And I knew Bob just the same through so many years. I'd done so many demos for him, etc. When he started doing these things, he's the one that reached out to me. Actually, no, I'll take that back. For the first one I did with him, it was the Queen one. And I remember I was working with Ricky Phillips, I think it was, at the time. We had a little outfit that we were trying to put together before he joined Styx. Mm-hmm. And he told me, hey, I got to go do this this Queen tribute album. I go, really? Who's doing it? And he told me the personnel that were involved in it. And I said, please tell Bob, I will pay him to let me be on it. Because I know Bob knows my voice. He knows my, but because it was Queen, it could have been anybody else. But because it was Queen, I told, please tell Bob, I would pay him that. He doesn't have to pay me to do it. I would pay him to be on it. Mm-hmm. That afternoon, I got a call from Bob. And of course, he's not going to make me pay him. He paid me what he paid everybody else. It was a scale rate for the same rate I got is the same rate Lemmy and Tommy Shaw and all the others that were doing these records with him. And he said, I'd love to have you on it. The only song I have left is the song called Save Me. And I go, perfect. It could have been the wackiest Queen song, could have been the heaviest. I didn't care. I just wanted to be on this record. Mm-hmm. And so I did the song Save Me on it. And that began a relationship with Bob that from that point onward, he was calling me for pretty much every one of the albums he was doing. I think the only one I turned down as a tribute album was when he was doing the Alice Cooper one. And the only reason I turned it down is because I was, no discredit to Cooper and his mm-hmm. music and his career, I just wasn't a fan enough to be able to, I didn't feel that I wanted to be part of something that wasn't part of my DNA growing up.
Sure, sure. Yeah,
it could be a session, I could fake it, wing it. But when I do those kind of things, I kind of want to be, I want that band or those songs to mean something to me instead of just doing it as a throwaway session. So I, from that point on, I did the Ozzy one. I did a Van Halen one with him. We did the Pink Floyd one together, Aerosmith. And I have so much fun doing them because it brings me back to the earlier part of our conversation when I was a top 40 hard rock singer, mm-hmm. singing all my favorite different genres and bands. and trying to impersonate them. So when I sing those things for Bob, I was going in there with not trying to sing them as Jeff Scott Soto, but trying to kind of get within the wheelhouse of those original versions of those songs. And that's, it was a lot of fun.
Sure, sure. Wow. That's great. Because I also heard another one, Drive My Car, you know, the Beatles one. And
I did Magical Mystery Tour on that album with Yngwie, actually.
Right. I mean, that's just...
But we're not in the studio. One thing people think, when we make those songs that we're all tracking together, mm-hmm. Bob was the same as a casting director. Mm-hmm. He made a list. This person is the kind of player that would be great for this song. This singer would be this kind of voice that would be perfect for this song. Mm-hmm. So he asked us, but because it's impossible to get every single one of those people that were on those records in the same room together at the same time,
yeah.
He would just pick them accordingly. And the one thing he was insistent on, and it was one of the rare times I did this. I always record my own vocals for everything I do. I'm in my own studio. I'm at my own timing, my own pacing. When I feel it, I sing it. But Bob, just like Paul O'Neill, he insisted, you got to come in. I got to be there tracking you. I got to know that what you're giving me is exactly what I want, as opposed to you doing it at home and thinking that's what I want.
Right.
He said, I did it with a few people. They turned in their tracks. That's not what, and we have to start from scratch. It's a waste of time. Mm-hmm. So he was one that I respected enough that when it was time to do those songs, I was gladly going into the studio working with him. And it was a great time. You know, we always had great conversations. I truly loved the friendship I had with Bob Kulick.
Right. Right. Wow. That's great. That's, he was just, he was really something. Yeah. I remember him very well. I wanted to ask you one thing here. This is something we kind of have fun with here, because I have all kinds of performers on here. I have musicians. I also have a lot of actors, comedians. I've had belly dancers on, jazz musicians,
awesome.
you name it, and radio personalities. And one thing I like to kind of ask about here, and I think you know what I mean by this, is Spinal Tap moments. Are there any you'd like to share?
There's one in particular. It's not really a Spinal Tap moment. I mean, a Spinal Tap moment is I'll give you the one that is a Spinal Tap moment. I swear. Because I think I saw the movie on that tour for the first time,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't shortly after this incident occurred.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what city we were in. It was the Yngwie tour with Talas. We were at some theater that it was a strange setup. There was no backstage behind the stage. Basically, the stage was you had to cut across the floor where the people were standing,
uh-huh.
and then you got into the lobby. You go up the stairs. And that's where the dressing rooms were.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a way to get there when the venue was open and the show started. You would actually go down to a second flight of steps. You'd go underneath the floor across the stage and then up some stairs and you'd be on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
Simple. So we did the sound check. Obviously, we used the floor to get to the dressing room. Show starts. Guys, the tour manager taking us to the stage. He shows us. We go down the stairs. Exactly as I mentioned, we're on stage doing our thing. Yngwie back then had a 22 to 27 minute guitar solo. And in the beginning, it was fun to listen to. It was interesting. But after 40 shows, you pretty much know what to expect. And as well, you know when it's the end of a solo. You know when the cue is that you got to get ready to be on stage for the next song. So normally I would go backstage. I would get a drink or, you know, towel off, change my shirt, whatever. This particular night was no exception. He started his solo. I went down the stairs, under the stage, underneath the people, up the stairs into the dressing room.
Mm-hmm.
La, 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 hanging out with Talas. Hey, Jeff, have a drink with us. Cool. We did. Hung out a little bit. Oh, there's the cue. There's my, I got to get back on stage. Zooming down the stairs, got back to this kind of passageway, and the door was locked.
Oh, no.
The door to go into the underneath section to get under the stage was locked.
Oh, no.
I'm like, oh, no. So I'm pounding, I'm pulling, and nothing to no avail. I go up to the main level, the lobby level. There's people that see me that they realize, what's he doing here? I go back down there. I'm trying to, like, bang in, trying to get back in. It's getting closer and closer to my cue that I have to be on stage. I say, and all of a sudden, Yngwie finishes. The next song begins. I have no choice. I went up to the floor level. And I literally was pushing my way through hundreds of people. It was jam-packed like sardines. Excuse me. Just pushing. People like, whoa, what's going on here? It's kind of the moment you and I had at the Sons of Apollo show, except this wasn't intended to be like this. I'm pushing my way. I finally had to jump on the stage without the guards, security pulling me off, thinking I was just some rabid fan, saying, no, I got to get up there. I literally got to the microphone right on time before the first vote, before the first line of the song. And it would have been one of those things. I was crapping my pants, because if I missed that cue, I know I would have heard it from Ingrid.
Right. Well, geez, so I bet you would have.
That's one of my favorite Spinal Tap moments.
That's hilarious.
Just having to push my way through people just to get back on stage to get right there for my vocal.
I had a similar experience happen with a doing a murder mystery. We had a volunteer from the audience that was supposed to be in it. And it was at the very end when we were solving the death and the mystery. And I turned around to say something to her, and she was gone. And this was on a riverboat that we were doing it. And I looked out the back door, and she was outside smoking.
Oh, no.
So I just stopped the show, and I said, ladies and gentlemen, hang on. Give me 2 seconds. And I just ran through the room, weaving through tables. And I went out, and I said, come on, lady, you're on. Get up here. You know?
That's
and,
awesome.
And yeah, but that's a lot of fun. We have a great time doing murder mysteries and stuff like that. And
I love that stuff. I've never seen one live. I've always wanted to see one.
Well, if you're ever in Maryland, look me up and you're in. You can definitely come see it. So, Jeff,
when you're back open and get to do it again, right?
That's the thing. We got to get this damn virus under control and out of here before we do it again. And
yeah,
we're all hurting, you know?
Oh yeah. Everyone is hurting in some way or another, whether you're a performer who can't perform, or you're dealing with the front line, and, or even just an essential worker and having to deal with people, careless people. And just in general, it's just a horrible situation for everyone.
It really is. And we just all have to do our part to get through it, you know? And then, yeah. And I have a feeling, because I've interviewed, again, I've spoken to some folks that are on Broadway that are shut down right now. And I just have a feeling, though, once things open back up, we're going to go through kind of an artistic renaissance in this country.
Yeah, I agree.
Not only are things going to get produced and be out there with a vengeance, I think a lot of people have been going back to the drawing board and just waiting to launch some really killer things, whether it be theater or songs or music or whatever.
Well, that's the good thing about this time. And I'll even add to that in the sense of what I've been able to gain from it. I've been so creative. I've been able to do a lot of sessions. Again, why my voice is so croaky right now. I was singing all day. Mm-hmm. I've been able to do a lot of things I normally wouldn't be able to do because of timing. Mm-hmm. Or I wouldn't be, I'd be on the road, so I'd have to turn it down. So it's certainly added to the creative side of things. I don't necessarily like it. I don't want this to be the reason, but you got to find a positive and a negative. And I was able to do that with the whole COVID situation in terms of my craft and what I'm doing for a living.
Right. One other thing I'd like to ask you before I have you do your shameless plugging here. I noticed that I was looking on one of your websites, and you had released a song with Soto to benefit the David Z Foundation. Could you tell me about the David Z Foundation and maybe how people could donate or something, or what it does?
Well, the David Z was, it seems like this whole interview is talking about people who have lost in my life.
Yeah.
Dearly departed, bass player and one of my dearest friends. It's difficult to talk about David without wanting to sell what an incredible human being he truly was. He was so youthful, and the guy was never, he was always happy. He was so youthful. He was one of the greatest musicians I've had the honor of playing with.
Oh yeah.
Greatest people, one of the greatest hangs, and everything you saw about David was not a facade. It was that and more. And that's one of the biggest compliments I can give to David in terms of what he brought to people. What, when you always put a smile on your face when that guy entered the room, because he was always just one of those positive. You could steal his bass, you could flatten his tire, you could punch him in the face, and he would find something positive to say out of it. That's David Z. So you add all the other things to it about his musicianship, his onstage antics, everything about this guy was so perfect. It was just too good to be true, and it's just one of those things where it's always the best ones that are taken too soon.
Right.
So anything that I'm doing, everything I did from that point that we lost him onward with Soto, even with Sons of Apollo, we did a song for him on the latest album that was dedicated to him. It was dedicated to him nightly. We participated in the last David Z kind of fundraiser that his brother is a big part of. And I'm actually, his brother called me a couple months ago, and he actually asked me to officially be a part of it, to be a kind of curator, to be a kind of he just wants me to be more a part of it as opposed to just being a contributor to it.
Right.
And so I'm proud to be a part of the whole thing in terms of when we get rolling again, we get to do all the things that the David Z Foundation stand for. That's when it's really going to blow up. And there are so many things in the works that are being planned, but of course, until the COVID situation is over, we can't really implement on them.
Right, right.
That being said, it's really easy, davidzfund.com. That's where you get all your information about what it's about, all the causes, and about what exactly the money goes towards. David basically is a staple of what it stands for in terms of paying it forward and giving it back, because we are huge components to being part of what we do and passing the baton forward for the next generation, for future generations that want to do what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I met him at a meet and greet again, after a TSO show, one of the years we went, and he was just, you know, a delightful person. He was very, you know, he was very honest and sincere, you know, when you talk to him, and it was like, every person in line that was meeting the band was important to him. He wasn't just phoning it in. He wasn't just like, yeah, lady, nice to meet you too. You know, he was very, very, he was a very sincere person. You know, he would look you right in the eye and speak to you. Right. And just a gentleman,
And what you see, there was no bullshit there. It was no facade. He was 1000% that person.
Yeah. Yep. So, I mean, you know, like I said, you've been, you've surrounded yourself with not only great musicians, but good guys throughout your career here, you know, and, wonderful. So, what I would like to do is, I feel like I really haven't plugged your new album enough here. So take a few minutes and tell us about that and where to get it. And I know you've had some other recent projects out, like, you know, a recent Sons of Apollo and a recent Soto album, Origami, I think it was. Tell us about those a bit and just where we can get them, and be as shameless as you want to be in plugging everything that you got. Go right ahead.
Sure. Well, I'll work backwards. Since the Soto record is the one that came out first. That was back in 2019. It would have been, that's our third album, and that's the band Soto, not to be confused with Jeff Scott's Soto solo albums.
Right.
The difference between those albums is, not only Soto is a band, it's a unit, it's a cohesive unit of band members. My solo albums are pretty much a smorgasbord of the people I want to work with, or whoever I'm working with, you know, at that point in that moment. Soto, we did our third album. It was for the same label as Sons of Apollo, so it was all new. It was all new for us to break new ground and to, you know, be able to move forward with. At first, we didn't know what we were going to do. We didn't know if we were going to be continuing after we lost David, who was going to take his place. And we got so fortunate that the same guy that was that took his place in TSO also happened to be the same guy that was the natural replacement in Soto. And the reason for that is Tony Dickinson was he was a major component in the early days of Soto. He was a writer of songs on the very first two Soto albums. So he was already kind of a silent partner of the situation as a songwriter. And he even played bass. His bass actually remained on the songs that he wrote for those two Soto records. So aside of the fact that he was the obvious choice, because he's ridiculously talented just the same, it just seemed like a perfect ending to the story that he's replacing David in TSO. So indeed, he should definitely take David's place in Soto as well. Mm-hmm. But that album, Oregon, came out last year. And then the new Sons of Apollo album, or the most recent, rather, was 2020. That came out in January of this year. And our tour was cut short because of COVID. We were in Europe, and we were just starting a European tour. We only got as far as 4 shows before we pulled the plug and came home. Mm-hmm. That being said, during that time, I was already working on a JSS solo album. And my solo albums are more on the melodic rock, hard rock, more, I guess, along the lines of the classic hard rock stuff that most people know me for. Mm-hmm. With Soto and Sons of Apollo, I'm trying to break new ground. With the JSS stuff, I'm more defining the ground that I've already broken. Mm-hmm. So that album just came out 2 weeks ago, Frontiers Records, and all these albums, it's the same as anybody else. You find them, it's easier to find them on whatever source you buy music these days, because Lord knows there aren't enough record stores or any record stores anymore. Mm-hmm. So you're going to find them in your Amazons, your Apple Musics, your mm-hmm. Spotify's, all the streaming services. That's where you can find anything Soto, JSS, or Sons of Apollo. Mm.
They were awesome. I've been, I wanted to, get, your current stuff, familiarize yeah. myself with it. So I've been listening to it on my walks, and, it's good stuff. And actually, you've been good for my health, because I've not wanted to stop listening. I wanted to listen to them awesome. All the way through and keep walking. So I get this carcass a little bit more exercise here by getting a little bit more, a little bit more distance, from listening to everything.
Funny thing, that's what I hear. I hear that listening to Soto when you're driving is actually a dangerous thing, because that music is so high energy and so pumping mm-hmm. that it actually makes you drive faster. It makes you more of a careless, you don't pay attention as much as you normally would mm-hmm. when you're not listening to that kind of music. So
right.
I guess the JSS stuff is good for motivation and walking, but the Soto stuff is if you need to get somewhere quickly and you don't have a lot of time to get there. You got to pedal to the metal kind of music.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us this evening. I've immensely enjoyed talking to you, and my mother-in-law Elaine is going to be thrilled to hear this once I get this ready to release and everything.
Please send her my best, and thank you for this. I mean, just the same, I have to thank folks like you to give me a platform to talk about the things that I do and the things that I've done. So mm-hmm. Without you, I can't get the word out either. So I appreciate you taking the time as well.
Absolutely. And like I said, whenever you have something to plug, and it seems like with you, it's about every 2 weeks looking at your discography here. But, anytime you want to come back and see us here on Foul Players Radio, we would love to have you. So, so thank you again, Jeff, and we will talk to you next time. And you're listening to Jeff Scott Soto on Foul Players Radio.
This podcast is part of the SJ Network. Go to s-j-network.com for more great podcasts and for contact information on publicist Steve Joyner.